Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/tripcast. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Texas Talking. Oh, what was that you said? Texas Talking. Gonna hoop up inside your head.
Hi, this is Austin Mayer Lee Leffingwell. Normally you'll find me on Channel 6, which nobody watches. That's why I'm the perfect person to intro today's Tribcast, which nobody listens to. And now here's your Tribcast host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you, Mayor Leffingwell. This is Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the first week of April 2013. Joining me is Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Editor Emily Ramshaw.
Good morning, afternoon, whatever time of day you're listening to this.
And assistant managing editor Ian Mitra.
Hi.
I'm going to throw an editor onto my title. Reporter editor.
Go for it.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I can't do podcast editor because that's Todd. Right. Let's move on.
First, you have to edit something.
Well, let's not. That's pretty demanding.
Yeah, that's a little premature.
Yeah. I thought we would give the people what they want today. I tweeted out and asked people what they wanted to talk about, and I got a lot of responses.
Since when do we care what they want?
Since last night. So I was surprised by how many people responded.
We're getting awfully consumer-friendly around here.
So what did they want?
Someone wanted us to tell them what is going on behind the scenes in Medicaid expansion.
Who was that?
It was a guy named Corey.
Corey.
So Emily.
Corey needs to get a life.
Emily, maybe you could tell us what is going on.
Hey, Corey, you ever heard of cable TV?
Yeah, right.
Behind the scenes in Medicaid expansion, or in front of the scenes, whichever side of the scenes you prefer.
A lot of things are happening in front of the scenes. So this week we had a massive dueling set of press conferences. We had Perry and Dewhurst and Cruz and Cornyn, plus a whole slew of other Republicans, noticeably absent Joe Strauss, who were basically gathered together in Austin at the Capitol to say, you know, we are not under any circumstances expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, in soft quotes. And so then right after that, there was a press conference featuring the Castro twins, Julian Castro's San Antonio mayor, Joaquin Castro, U.S. representative from San Antonio. And they were basically taking the alternate approach, which is that Texas absolutely needs to expand Medicaid and bring, you know, more poor adults into subsidized care. What's going on behind the scenes is probably far more interesting than what's going on in front of the scenes. And what's
That's
going
always
on,
the case.
Yes, it generally is the case. Sometimes it's boring. But in this case, what you have are lawmakers in both chambers now who are Republican lawmakers who are trying to sort of figure out a way to draw down these federal dollars without calling it expanding Medicaid. So, you know, in the House, you have John Zerwas, who has a Republican of Simonton, an anesthesiologist who's filed sort of a shell bill that would allow the legislature to come up with some kind of solution like some of these other states have done. And then we had breaking news last night that in the Senate, Tommy Williams is going to be backing some form of legislation, or he's pitching a proposal that would basically collect new taxes accrued from people who sign up for insurance policies under the state's insurance exchange, and use that starting in 2015 to subsidize private health care plans for the poor uninsured.
So does it create new taxes?
So it doesn't create new taxes because these are premium taxes that would naturally be collected as a result of more people signing up for enrolling in insurance in Texas. So they're very careful to say it's not a new tax. They're also very careful to say that this is not an expansion of Medicaid, because what you'd be doing is drawing more of those poor Texans onto private insurance rolls. So this is the first sign that Republicans, you know, are working towards some kind of a plan that would expand coverage to poor people, if not quote-unquote Medicaid coverage to poor people.
So I know, I mean, we've been talking in stories about preferences for block grants, too. How would this affect? I know it's the Tommy Williams plan is kind of in its early stages, but you know, how does this work in terms of block grants?
It really, this, the Tommy Williams proposal doesn't say anything about block grants. The people who are talking about block grants are Rick Perry and the state's Republican leadership and, you know, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, the conservative think tank. They want the federal government basically to give Texas effectively a blank check, you know, to run Medicaid the way that Texas sees fit. The reality is the Obama administration is not going to do that, especially without strings attached that say, you know, you're going to expand coverage to X number of uninsured people. So, you know, but there's a, what's fascinating is this divide between what you're hearing at the top from the state's Republican leadership and what you're seeing starting to happen behind the scenes, which is lawmakers saying, you know, we don't want to pass up this money entirely, or, you know, we want to find ways to cover more people.
But would the Williams plan actually draw, I mean, one of the issues is that we're passing up a chance to draw down like $100 million from the feds, right? And would the Williams plan still draw down that money, or would we still forego that money?
$100 billion.
I slipped up.
Yeah. Just a couple of zeros.
A few zeros.
One letter.
It's unclear to me so far whether it didn't sound like it, like it would draw down all that money. You know, it calls for the federal government has to roll out this health insurance exchange in Texas, which is sort of like an Orbitz for health insurance. Texas had the option to do it itself. Texas has chosen not to so far. So the federal government will create its own sort of Orbitz program for health insurance in Texas. And, you know, by nature of the taxes generated, the premium taxes generated by what they're accounting for is, you know, a surge in enrollment now that health insurance coverage is mandatory. That's where they're hoping to see this revenue. So the early plan to me did not indicate that they would draw down all those federal dollars, but it also didn't. It also seems to leave the door open, you know, for those conversations down the road.
I think they're kind of playing green eggs and ham with Perry, you know, where he said, I don't want to eat this. And they said, well, would you try it on a boat? Would you try it with a goat? And they're trying to figure out a way. Some of the Republicans are trying to figure out a way to draw down some of this federal money and to expand these insurance programs and these health care programs without tripping the wire of saying we're expanding Medicaid.
Right. Or we're creating a new tax.
Right. And, you know, the Medicaid thing is interesting. You know, one of the arguments against Medicaid is that the program's broken, and so we shouldn't expand a program that's broken. One of the counter arguments is, well, this is a state-run program. You broke it. You've been the governor for 12 years. Fix it. And this is where the block grants come back in. This is where they start talking about it. I can't figure out why the Republicans, the Perry gang, primarily hasn't been talking about the CHIP program. We already have an example of a medical program in Texas that's essentially a block grant program that the state's running and seems to be working fairly well, but they don't want to take credit for that and say, here's an example of, it's also kind of hard to get a list out of these guys of what an ideal Medicaid program would look like.
Well, that's interesting. You know, the Texas Public Policy Foundation released their own plan for how to reform Medicaid. Perry's office does not appear to have embraced that plan. And, you know, at this press conference, I asked, so, you know, who's driving the car? Who's negotiating here? And there was sort of this silence for a moment. And then, you know, Perry said, well, this is Commissioner, you know, Kyle Janik, the health commissioner's job. Well, actually, it's the job of the legislature to direct Kyle Janik to negotiate with the feds. In other states, you're seeing the governors negotiating, Republican governors negotiating directly with the Obama administration. That's not happening here.
Right.
Did either of these, either the roundtable sort of photo op or the Castro's press conference really move the dial on the debate either way?
Not at all. I mean, both of those were political rhetoric. The, you know, Tommy Williams, John Zerwas behind the scenes negotiating is where stuff's actually going to happen.
What also just what about Representative Lois Kolkhorst did a video trying to explain these things. How I found it actually very helpful. So kudos to her. But how were her numbers in that?
I mean, I think that what Kolkhorst's math shows is that there are elements of the Affordable Care Act that, you know, are actually benefiting Texas and that Texas, therefore, you know, does not necessarily need to expand Medicaid. Now, her argument is that, look, I'm just laying out all the numbers here and you can read between the lines and you can make your own decision. She's not saying, you know, this is my opinion one way or the other on this.
She's also taking really great care to say, I'm not advocating an expansion of Medicaid or against one.
Right, exactly.
And but so, wasn't the video put out by the governor's office?
So the governor's office put it up on his website, you know, I think to say, you know, look at this good math and all this, you know, great whiteboard drawing, and this is someone doing the numbers. I haven't heard anybody yet challenging her numbers. You know, I think it's interesting that what she lays out is an explanation that can be taken, you know, one way or another. It can be taken as a, we don't need to, we should not expand Medicaid. It can be taken as, the Affordable Care Act is actually doing some pretty good things for Texas.
Yeah, well, it seemed like the basic argument was, look how much the Affordable Care Act does to bring down our level of uninsured
already,
people
right.
on its own without expanding Medicaid. So it sort of seems to sort of de facto assume the benefits of the Affordable Care Act.
It says, yeah, it says basically that the exchanges will bring the uninsureds down to, help me out here, Emily, down to 16%.
16%.
Ian did his homework.
And so that a bunch of the reductions in the uninsureds in Texas would happen as a result of the exchanges and not as a result of, or, you know, would happen with or without expansion of Medicaid. So, and she sort of stops there. The issue here is whether the state would benefit by taking some expansion of Medicaid, and specifically whether the state would benefit by taking some of these federal monies. You know, it's $100 billion over 10 years, but the first 3 years of it until 2016, I think, are free money, basically, and, you know, in the sense that the federal government's saying we'll pay for those years without any state input.
Right.
And because of the Supreme Court decision on the Federal Health Care Act, the states can opt out of the Medicaid expansion anytime they want to. The Supreme Court said that the federal government doesn't have the constitutional right to compel the states to play. So Chris Christie and Rick Scott and Jan Brewer and some other Republican governors like that have looked at it and said, we're going to take the 3 years, we're going to see how it works, and if it doesn't work, or if the federal government, if the strings are unacceptable, we're going to opt out. And there are a lot of Republicans in Texas that are asking Perry, kind of behind the scenes, why aren't we doing this?
Some of this stuff, like the Williams plan, the deadline for filing bills is passed. How does that get into the debate?
I mean, it gets into the debate via, they've got these shell bills that they filed precautionarily. Look, I mean, anything can become a Christmas tree. You know, you can tack on amendments, you can
just
pass.
Just a little bit of folksy wisdom from Emily Ramshaw.
Yeah, I've put on my Ross Ramsey hat.
Don't blame me.
You know, budget writers are my personal favorite way to see things snuck into legislation. So there's always a way to do this.
So never give up. Anything can become a Christmas tree.
Exactly.
We should, before moving on, acknowledge our sponsor, Audible.com, where you can get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial if you go to audibletrial.com/Tribcast it's or like, Texas Tribune.
It's like a Christmas tree right here in the middle of the podcast.
You better get that right.
Well, I look that
Audible
up.
Might
well,
yank
I look that
yank
up.
Your
Ross,
funding.
Why don't you tell us some of your favorite audiobooks that you didn't mention the last time? You gave us a laundry list of them.
I love the way you prep me for these. The Signal and the Noise by Nate Silver is really good. I just finished reading it. This is the guy who started a polling blog. He actually started a baseball blog, and you know, was a sabermetrician, one of the guys that does all the numbers in baseball. And then started looking at politics. The New York Times grabbed it, grabbed him, made a blogger out of him, and he was the guy who got the election results right. And basically argues in the book that the way you do this is by, you know, you have to filter information away from noise, and, you know, talks about it for some length.
That is the opposite of what we try to do here.
This really reminds me of these laser hair removal ads on TV or on the radio where some burly guy is like, you know, I went and got...
No, I'm a burly
apparently
guy.
I'm just watching on TV wow. at 2 in the morning.
Right. No, I mean, you know, us like...
Confessions
about,
of an insomniac.
talking about the books that we've read lately.
Are you saying that... Ross is a burly guy getting hair removal?
Exactly.
Apparently, I didn't know I was doing that.
It explains
male pattern baldness, though. It's because I read so much.
You, too, can be like Ross if you go to audibletrial.com/tribcast. All right. On Thursday this week, which may very well be the day or the day before you listen to this podcast, the House will be debating the budget. Are we expecting to debate sort of a walk in the park, I think.
Yeah, you know, the Senate always has a walk in the park, and they had the beatification of Tommy Williams a couple of weeks ago when they did their budget. No amendments. They talked about it on the floor. They talked about how much they enjoyed the process and what a great guy Tommy Williams was, and then they voted nearly unanimously for the budget. Send it over to the House, where their version of that kind of debate is pre-filing 267 amendments.
Right.
And it's basically everybody trying to get into the budget or get out of the budget, everything that they either have thought of since the campaigns or that they promised during the campaign. So Aman Bathija on our staff had a really great story this week on, I think it was 11 freshmen.
11 freshmen and, what, 37 amendments?
Right. And, you know, so they're trying to pull money out of, they're trying to make a point. They wanted to talk about pensions some, and they're talking about things in the budget that they think are silly. So they're trying to pull money away from things in the budget that they think are silly, that should not be state priorities, and toward things that they think should be state priorities. That's a microcosm of everything that's going on in a budget fight in the House. They have a rule that says you can't add spending to the budget. So in order to find money for your thing, you have to take money away from some other thing. And so you'll have a bunch of amendments all day that say, you know, take the money out of this program, put it in that program, take the money out of this program, put it in that program. And they're basically trying, it's the members' chance on the floor to try to get a majority of the House to go along with their revisions to what the Appropriations Committee's been doing. If it goes like it's gone in the past, they'll get a couple on, but not many.
Some of the, I was talking to folks at the Texas Cultural Trust. One of the amendments that David Simpson, representative from
Longview.
Nice. All three for three. You all got it.
Right. And a fellow Vanderbilt grad.
Vanderbilt grad. One of the things that...
Do we have to talk about Vanderbilt again?
that was another request from Twitter, that we talk about Vanderbilt.
Talk about Vanderbilt.
Right.
The Commodore's Amendment.
Now I just want to talk about that and not even talk about what I was going to say.
David Simpson is much more entertaining than...
David Simpson, because of his Vanderbilt connections. Vanderbilt, not Vanderbilt, David Simpson was going to... He wants to move money from the Commission on the Arts over
this
to
podcast
the
podcast comes with a graphic explaining what you're talking about.
Yeah, over to the volunteer fire department and
give
the people.
A whiteboard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Lois Kolkhorst will have a presentation. What yeah. Reeve was trying to say.
Is Vanderbilt also a sponsor of the TripCast?
I don't know. Luckily, they're not a public university and can't have any of their money taken away by the budget fight in Tennessee. No, so he wants to move money from the Commission on the Arts to the Volunteer Fire Department, Fire Services. The Cultural Trust, which is a nonprofit that sort of supports arts and the Commission on the Arts, basically says, oh, this is a false choice. We can't do this. But it seems like all choices are going to come down to something like that, right?
Right. I mean, you know, everything in the budget is, you know, it's a list of priorities. It's kind of the, you know, this is, it really is the central policy document of the government. These are the things that we're going to take your money and purchase or serve you with. I mean, these are the products and services, and if you don't like that list, or if something is on that list that you think is less important than something that's not on that list, that's why they're here. They got elected to come in here and try all of these ideas. You know, they've decided in the past that the Cultural Trust is more important than some of the things they don't fund, and we're just going to get another test of that.
The Commission on the Arts, they don't fund the Cultural Trust. They just have views on it.
What he said.
I love the budget fight day in the House. It's like my favorite day of the session, aside from Sonny Dye, of
course.
Sonny
Dye is the greatest.
Yeah. Right. But it's just like the most entertaining, and you really see all the, you know, fangs come out, and it's just wild theater.
Well, and they do raise some interesting questions. You know, there are always some things in the budget that are sort of on the margin that you say, you know, if times were tough, we might not be doing that. And there's always something that they're not funding or that they're not doing that you go, why are, and this is how they form these questions, why are you doing that if you're not doing this? So we'll get a whole day of that on Thursday.
Well, and it's interesting, too, with these freshmen. I mean, these amendments they add, they're all kind of focused on this one pension, this teacher retirement. And I don't know how many people even knew that, you know, what the status of this pension was. So it's kind of interesting.
Part of their point.
Which mm-hmm. was the point they were trying to make, which I don't think a lot of people knew about. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, there are some interesting programs that they're targeting, too, which will certainly drive up some debate, I imagine, this week. So things like the TCEQ and a couple other things that are, you know, I know the controller's office had a program that they wanted to get some more money for, and it's just not going to happen. And it'll be interesting to see how, you know, these programs are defended this week.
And how much of a role does like Empower Texans and Michael Quinn Sullivan play in a week like the budget week?
You know, they haven't been successful in the few debates that we've had so far. So there have been a couple of times when they amassed, you know, some number of votes against. You know, they had a pretty interesting run on the sunset bill on the Public Utility Commission. They had some attempts on the water bill. They had some attempts in the education bill, and they fell short every time. In a budget, you know, the budget goes all day long, and, you know, for the most part, in an ordinary circumstance, the House sticks with the author. So they'll mm-hmm. stick with Jim Pitts on most of the votes. But every once in a while, you'll come up with something. Something will get posed at either exactly the right moment or exactly posed in the right way where the House goes, wait a minute, that's kind of interesting. And that's when the author of a bill is in trouble, when mm-hmm. everybody on the floor is going, well, wait a minute, let's hear this challenge out. You know, what happens on the budget is that the you'll get a read on the House. You'll see, I think this is where we really see where this huge freshman class really stands on particular issues and on particular things, how cohesive they are. And it's also where the people who are ultimately going to settle the differences between the House and Senate budgets get a read on the House and get a read on the Senate. So when the conference committee goes to reconcile the differences between the House version of this and the Senate version of this, one of the things they're going to have at hand and they're going to be conscious of is, you know, we had 78 votes for this in the House, or we had 120 votes for this in the House, and that's going to be one of their arguing points. So one of the things that you're trying to do if you're a member of the House who's not on the conference committee or not on the appropriations committee is get your idea into consideration for the conference committee.
Ross, you've written a lot about how many freshmen there are, you know, and how many new legislators.
I'm obsessed.
So, I mean, you know, you've talked about traditionally they'll stick with Pitts in this case. I mean, do you see any kind of dynamic changing with so many freshmen? I mean, we kind of seen a hint of something different with these amendments.
That's the question. You know, whenever someone's, whenever someone is at the front mic presenting a bill, in this case, Jim Pitts, there are, you know, some number of floor captains out there trying to keep the members in line. So there'll be, you know, five to 10 members of the House kind of walking around, checking everybody, you know, kind of lobbying on Pitt's behalf.
Taking temperatures.
Right, as the day goes on. And then as each of these other things comes up, you'll see these little coalitions form. So, you know, we've got these 11 freshmen who are trying this pile of amendments. You know, there may be a group of people that if you threw out a thing defunding standardized testing in schools, some instant other coalition forms. If you throw out something on Medicaid expansion, some other instant coalition forms. And really the ebb and flow of the debate will depend on how those coalitions go and how the floor captains for Pitts, you know, manage the floor. And, you know, that's actually the part that's fun to watch.
And it's not all choices between X and Y. Like, you know, I'm particularly interested in Pitts has these amendments going after the University of Texas regents and basically putting restrictions on how they can spend their money, how they can't spend money. He has right now the system gets a big pot of money that can really only be used for sort of academic stuff at UT Austin, but then the system can use sort of for whatever they want.
Right.
And it would eliminate the system's ability to have any authority over that money, and it would just go all straight to UT Austin. He has another that would say that the system can't use money for investigations of their administrations of their universities. He also just takes away some of their money and gives it to the coordinating board for safekeeping until basically the governor and the LBB decide that it's time for the system to receive that money.
Well, in some cases like that, you know, they'll actually add an amendment like that sometimes with the intent of taking it off before the end of the session, but they want to hold the pressure point over, in this case, the UT regents for the next 60 days while they're, you know, that's still in the budget. We don't have to take it out. You know, that becomes their threat.
Well, I guess that's our budget talk. Anything else to watch for?
No, I think, you know, the two things really here are what kind of budget they get out. I expect it'll be something pretty close to what Pitts wants at this point. Mm-hmm. And to watch kind of how the House plays. You know, the interesting thing about the freshmen right now is that it's a big unknown in some ways. There's, you know, there are 44 of them. There's 67 members in the House who are either freshmen or sophomores. And they don't necessarily play according to tradition. It's not because they're, you know, against the tradition, but they are all looking at the same thing everybody else is. We got elected to come up here and do some stuff. It may or may not be in line with, you know, your crazy cultural traditions, and we get to see if they've fallen in line or not.
Seems like Strauss and Pitts will have been doing their homework and, you know, really in the days leading up to this had some very serious meetings with those folks to make sure that this doesn't turn into a total circus.
Right.
Hopefully they haven't listened to this podcast before the debate.
Right. Of course not.
And then what are the next steps for this? So the House passes whatever they pass.
Right. The Senate already passed a budget. The House passes a budget. They look at each other's budgets. They go, they go and say, okay, five members from the House, five members from the Senate, go work out the differences, and we'll see you in May.
Well, is this version that's going to come up on Thursday the committee's, the House substitute for the Senate's version?
Yeah, the committee Senate substitute? Bill will come over. The first thing right. they'll do is they'll say, strike everything below the caption and substitute the House bill.
Right.
And then, so the House will have a version of the budget. And I don't have the numbers in front of me. I think they're $2 to $2.5 billion different. There's $1 billion in difference on education. You know, Amon did a story sort of, you know, head-to-head on the budget. They've got a lot of things to reconcile, and a lot of it is sort of like way down in the machinery, and some of it's this top-line stuff that we pay attention to. You know, how much are they spending on education? How much are they spending on health and human services? Those kinds of things. But it takes a good month to work out the differences.
Well, Ian, as someone who reads just about every story that gets published on the Tribune, are there any that stand out this week that you think we should cover before we wrap up here?
Well, there were some kind of interesting, we were talking a little earlier, some interesting developments with CPRIT. I think that's probably worth kind of touching in. I think we had the story from Becca yesterday about kind of this, the foundation that was created, affiliated with the Institute, kind of going on their own and trying to wind down. And some folks aren't too thrilled with that and how they've changed their name and kind of are acting with, you know, somewhat unilaterally.
So they, so the CPRIT Foundation, let me just get this straight. So the CPRIT Foundation, or any nonprofit organization, was founded in order to supplement, to help out CPRIT, basically, right?
Right, yeah, and supplement, I think, some salaries for some of the people on the board.
All right, and then, and they're tangled up in the whole CPRIT, you know, scandal because there's some controversy over perceived or potential conflicts of interest. You know, there were members of the people who were donating to the CPRIT Foundation who were also receiving, who had also invested in projects that received grants from CPRIT.
Right, right.
Okay. And so the foundation has now sort of, without anyone's permission, changed its name.
Right. So,
well, that federal witness protection program. Right. They moved it right. to Scottsdale, to a nondescript neighborhood.
I mean, right. And so, I guess the question is whether they can do that, or whether they have the right to, you know.
And how they're choosing to wind down with their funding too. It seems like there's some money there that officials want to make sure goes to the Institute, if at all, you know, if possible. That there's some expenses that the foundation has that they say that they still have some outstanding bills.
Legal bills, maybe.
Yeah, legal bills.
But isn't the foundation going to shut down now? Isn't that basically?
So within 60 days is what they're saying. They're winding down within 60 days. But it's unclear to me whether they're going to still try to be, to constitute. Look, I mean, there was clearly a purpose for some foundation to support CPRIT's mission.
Right. I was going to ask, where does the function go if you close this down?
Right, exactly. Because, you know, CPRIT alone couldn't afford, you know, some of the salaries to bring these researchers to Texas, which was why the money was coming in from somewhere else. I mean, you see this all the time. Isn't that part of what, like, you know, the UT Law Foundation?
This is very, very much tied to UT Law School Foundation and the whole sort of controversy surrounding that. And just other foundations. This is sort of a growing theme in the Capitol discussions and talks around the state is, you know, we have all these nonprofit foundations that are very closely linked to the point of being not independent from state organizations.
Right.
To help supplement the activities that the state can't fund.
Well, they have the same sort of intrinsic conflict of interest that, you know, you have with political donations. The only people who give to foundations for this or that are the people who have an interest in this or that.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, the people who are getting salary supplements or whatever from these foundations are getting salary supplements from the people who will benefit or hurt because of their actions. It's, you know, it's riddled with conflicts, the very idea of it.
Right.
But it is hard to figure out, I think, how to fund some of these activities if you don't have these outside sources of income.
If it costs that much money and you want to get it done, you have to spend that much money. You know, you can't hide it in some foundation. I mean, if the state wants to get something done that requires, you know, $400,000 a year employees, they have to start paying people $400,000 a year.
But then does that make them, you know, less competitive, say, with private universities or with, you know?
Well, not if they have the same money the private universities do.
Right.
But they don't have the money the private universities do.
It doesn't look like they're going to get it anytime soon.
So you either pony up, you know, just on the face of it, which they're obviously not willing to do, or you set up these things to supplement the salaries, which gets the same thing done but introduces this conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I mean, maybe, yeah, without the political.
One problem of the things with the Law School Foundation is that basically there was no way to track, and we've talked about this, there was no way to track the supplements that they were providing because they were it was just a, the separate nonprofit giving it to the faculty. And now it's going, they're giving it to the university, which then gives it to the faculty. So now there's a record of that compensation.
Right.
So are there better ways to set these things up than it seems like either of these foundations were set up initially?
Right. Yeah.
Right.
But there's no better way to finish a podcast than on that note. So on behalf of Emily Ironross and our producer, our podcast editor, Todd, and any of you that have questions or comments and want to email them to tribcast@texastribune.org or get your free audiobook from...
Free?
Yes. Or laser hair removal. You can go to audibletrial.com/tribcast. You can maybe get Ross Ramsey's new line of children's books, Rick Perry's Green Eggs and Ham. We'd also like to thank Shiny Ribs for our wonderful theme music.
I thought that was going to be a barbecue restaurant.
Yeah. You seem to be getting a lot of things wrong.
You had me for just a second, right?
Remember, everything can be a Christmas tree. This is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
I'm in a bad mood today. It's true.